All right, off we go. So I'm going to tell you about progress on the fast scrambling conjecture so much as an exploration around the perimeter of the fast scrambling conjecture that I've made over the past few months with Nima Lashkari, who's a PhD student at McGill and whose work, I guess, was also presented by Alex Maloney earlier this week, and Douglas Stanford, who's a PhD student at Stanford, and will be presenting on another topic also in this session. So scrambling, the scrambling time, is the minimum time required for some kind of localized information to become inaccessible without measuring a fraction order one of an entire system. And I use localized in quotes because what I really mean is that if the information is encoded in some natural degrees of freedom, then you're interested in the amount of time required before you can recover that before that information becomes delocalized with respect to that decomposition. So for normal systems, this scrambling time is expected to scale polynomially with the linear size of the system. And that if we have the scrambling time, which is going to appear over and over again in the talk, T star, has to be at least as long as it takes for the information to get delocalized in the system, right? And so there's just a causality bound which tells us that T star has to grow at least as L. And if it's, for example, diffusive, then it's going to have to grow like L squared. And of course, the temperature appears in there to set the energy scale properly. And if the entropy of the system is extensive, then we can just replace L by entropy to the power of 1 over D. And this tells us how the scrambling time is going to scale parametrically with the number of degrees of the effective number of degrees of freedom of the system. So that's what happens for normal physical systems. But it seems that for certain special kinds of physical systems, this scrambling time is much, much faster than you would expect. So for Schwarzschild black holes, for a thermal cell of an ADS black hole, a static patch of De Sitter space, some estimates based on how long it takes for charge to spread in such systems indicate that the scrambling time doesn't scale polynomially with the number of degrees of freedom, but logarithmically with the number of degrees of freedom, which is very strange. It's in fact quite difficult to find systems that have that behavior. And that's going to be part of the goal of this talk, is just to see whether we can find rigorously any physical systems that have this behavior. And the conjecture, which I guess was made formally in a paper by Sacchino and Susskind, and also explored further in Susskind's follow-up, is that no physical system can, in fact, scramble information faster than this logarithm of S bound. I don't know if how specific Lenny wants to be. We could ask the question, is there any Hamiltonian physical system that scrambles faster than this? I don't think that's actually true. If you impose some reasonable conditions on the structure of the Hamiltonian, like you only have two or k-body interactions for bounded k, we'll get to that. It in fact generally doesn't. You still have a. You seem to still have a logarithmic lower bound on the scrambling time in that case, although the naive propagation argument that I gave doesn't apply to that case. Now, one of the motivations for speculating that we can't actually scramble information faster than this comes from the need for self-consistency of the black hole complementarity principle, and that was explored in a paper that John Preskill and I wrote, and I guess John alluded to earlier on. And just to remind people of where the connection would come from, I'm just going to tell you very briefly, recap, this connection between scrambling information and communicating. And so if our goal is actually to send some quantum states, so here I have a schematic picture of information getting lost inside a black hole. So there's a black hole that starts off maybe in a pure state. That's B. There's a message system M. Something happens, some unitary dynamics, and out comes some radiation, and then a black hole state after the radiation. And we're interested in whether we can recover quantum states that have dropped in through M from the radiation degrees of freedom. So is there some physical operation, D, that can be performed such that that quantum state M will be recovered from the radiation? And that actually, from a mathematical perspective, is completely equivalent to just establishing entanglement between, if we dropped an entangled, half of an entangled state into the quantum, into the black hole, we want to establish entanglement between the half we didn't drop in and the radiation degrees of freedom. And if we can do that, then we can communicate. But it turns out that if you can establish radiation or entanglement between the reference and the radiation, that's completely equivalent to destroying all correlations between this reference and what's left behind in the black hole. That entanglement is such a strong form of correlation, it's so monogamous, that if you really have good correlation or entanglement between the reference and the radiation, you can have no correlation whatsoever. And it's if and only if. And so we can, well, let's call the state at this point sigma. If we wanted to write it mathematically, if we trace over the radiation degrees of freedom of the sigma density operator, what we should get is a tensor product density operator between the reference and the black hole. And if that's the case, then there exists some unitary transformation of the radiation that will recover an entangled state that purifies the reference system just from those radiation degrees of freedom. Okay, so that's, and this is the connection to scrambling. This is where why the scrambling timescale comes into the question of how quickly we can recover radiation. Yeah. This is true regardless. Like this statement is true for any quantum mechanical state. So if you have a quantum mechanical state of three subsystems of this type, if when you trace over one of the subsystems you have a tensor product, then you can always do this. Okay. Well, if R is zero bits, then tracing over it is a null operation, right? So you'll never actually destroy correlation. No, it is, right? Because you won't be able to satisfy this condition if R is zero bits. Yeah. If you can satisfy this condition, right? So if you succeed, so the point, let's look at what this condition means, right? Because this is really where scrambling comes in. So the point is the density operator on B prime has no memory whatsoever of what the state on M was that actually went into the black hole. Right, and so this is the condition that needs to be met. And so if the density operator on B prime really is independent of what was dropped into the black hole, then you can recover the information by just looking at the reference. And that is effectively what we mean by scrambling. Because if you've completely scrambled the degrees of freedom, then when you look at a subsystem, which is the B prime subsystem, it will no longer have any recollection of what the original state was, or perturbation, or in this case, you know, information dropped into the black hole. So that's the reason. That's one of the reasons that we care, and it's going to come up again a little bit later. So big picture versus toy examples. So I'm told that string theory descriptions of black holes couple the degrees of freedom non-locally, and we can look, for example, at the BFSS matrix model. It has this property. So the Lagrangian has a kinetic part. It has this second term, which involves the trace of a commutator squared. And that second term, if you look at the matrix entries of these matrix degrees of freedom, every pair of matrix entries appears together in at least one term. And so you're effectively coupling everything to everything. And that at least suggests that you might be able to scramble very quickly. But so far all that is really known is by analogy. Right, we look at the classical system that is supposed to be modeled by this thing, and then we look at relaxation processes like the spreading of charge. And what we'd really like to know is that by direct analysis of, say, this matrix model or some other stringy model of black holes or other, I guess, cosmological systems, since this is a cosmology conference, we'd like to show that that's a fast scrambler. But that's hard, right? Because to do that, you actually really need to be able to describe in great detail the time evolution of a very large quantum mechanical system. That this is effectively, you need to track its approach to equilibrium, not just locally, but for subsystems that are a constant fraction of the whole thing. And so that's, in general, a very difficult question, although people, I guess, like Yasuhiro is trying to tackle this as we speak. The goal of this talk is more modest. So I'd like to find examples of toy systems that do scramble quickly, just to start to get a feel for what kinds of Hamiltonians might actually do this, and then prove general lower bounds on scrambling times, so we can at least develop some confidence that the conjecture is true. And so the idea then is to at least be able to say that fast scrambling is possible, and that, well, I guess we'll also see that in some sense, scrambling faster than the conjectured bound may also be possible. So I don't have that much time, and I don't think there's really any chance that I'll get through the entire talk, but I'm going to go through three different classes of examples of systems. So the first is called Brownian quantum circuits, then the Ising interaction on random graphs, and finally something called Feynman circuit simulator. And if we get to the lower bounds on scrambling time at the end, those are using techniques called Lieb-Robinson bounds. So Brownian circuits. Let's just start with a regular quantum mechanical circuit, the kind of thing I think John Preskill alluded to this, but just so you can get a feel for what's going on. We'll have n qubits. And I should say that in quantum information, we have this tendency to talk about qubits. But those are just units. Right? So the finite dimensionality is often important for our conclusions. But the fact that we're talking about lots of two-dimensional systems is really just that we're looking for the best granularity possible. So we'll have n qubits. And there's time. And in circuits, we typically subdivide the time into discrete periods. We'll choose, say, pairs of qubits and allow those to interact in some way. So per time step, we could have, if they're n qubits, up to n over 2 interactions between pairs. And that's done in a controlled way, and the interaction varies as a function of time, and that allows us to build up interesting unitary transformations. So it's been known for a while, and one of the reasons that this came up in the paper with John, that if you design such a circuit in a very clever way, that you can actually scramble in a time that's order log n. So n here is like the number of degrees of freedom, like the entropy of the system. And so it can be done, but you have to choose these gates in a very ingenious way. It doesn't look like anything that would ever appear in nature. And so that doesn't really solve our problem for us yet. So it's very ingenious. It requires the injection of certain types of random choices along the way. And we'd like to replace it by something a little bit more physical. Well, that's a good question. I'm not going to impose an idea of locality because I'm thinking about something like the matrix model where there is no locality. And if you impose locality, that's going to dominate the time. So what I should say, I'm looking for something, say, that's time independent, doesn't require some tuning of the interactions in some clever way. What else do I want to? Yeah. Okay, well, no, yeah, so certainly time independence isn't required. But I guess, like, in the case of if we want the property of scrambling to be inherent to the interaction between a certain set of particles, then what you just want is a fixed Hamiltonian that describes how they interact, not somebody turning knobs that sort of forces them to do strange things. There should be no dependence on the state you started from. Yeah. Yeah. So that's a good question. And that model has been studied. While I don't think anybody believes that doesn't scramble in time order log n, there's still actually I's to dot and T's to cross for the convergence of that. So my Brownian quantum circuit will involve something very much along those lines. So each of these GIs is going to involve some random pairwise interaction. So basically, each of these GIs is going to be a Hermitian matrix where I just sum over all pairs of qubits. So this superscript is identifying a location. And then the subscript is identifying an operator. So these are qubits, so I'm going to choose four operators that form a basis. And then I'll just choose the coefficients, say, independently and identically as Gaussians, with mean zero and some variance epsilon. So this gives us, this is just describing a random interaction that changes at each time step. And then we can look, well, of course, it generates some kind of Brownian motion or some diffusion on the unitary group. but not an isotropic, well, not the usual diffusion, because we haven't included all the generators of SU 2 to the n here. We've only included certain generators corresponding to two-body interactions. We can take the infinitesimal, the limit as epsilon goes to zero, as epsilon becomes infinitesimal, and what you get is this diffusion process, and you can study it, right? There's an Edo stochastic differential equation that describes the time evolution for the unitary transformation, and then you can just try to see, okay, well, how does the entanglement or the scrambledness of a subsystem vary as a function of time? Sorry? So epsilon is the variance of these Gaussians. So you're taking the variance to zero as the number of steps goes to infinity. So let's study entanglement production in the system, which is really the measure of how scrambled it is as a function of time. So we'll have a state psi of t, and the density operator for a subsystem s of those qubits 1 through n will then just be psi sub s, where we trace over the complement of s, the state psi of t. And we'd be interested in the entanglement entropy between that subsystem and the complement. But it's actually easier to look at this quantity that we call the purity, which is just the trace of the density operator squared. And this quantity, it has the property that it will be 1 if and only if the state is pure, because if the density operator of a pure state is a rank 1 projector. And at the opposite extreme, for a maximally mixed state, a state proportional to the identity operator, will be 2 to the minus s, 1 over the dimension. And presumably, this quantity decreases as a function of time, but not so straightforwardly, because it's actually an Edo process, actually much rougher than what I've drawn here. And we'd like to see what happens. So we can smooth over different trajectories to get something that looks more like the red line. And we can simplify our lives by starting out with a state which is not entangled, right? So it's a pure product state. So the each of these H sub S's really does start off at a value 1, because if we look at any subsystem, we have a pure state. Now, if you do that, a small miracle occurs, and what you get is a system of ordinary differential equations that close with respect to, so I'm looking at the average of this purity for a subsystem S. With this symmetry, it depends only on the size of S, and I'll call the size of SK. So our system of differential equations just looks like so. So more or less, it looks like an averaging process. HK is, it looks like it's being averaged with HK minus 1 and HK plus 1, but the coefficient is a little bit more negative than it should be for something that, to be kind of heat-like. And that leads to an extra decay. Now, and I guess given the, I guess I can say a little bit here. So what's going to happen, actually, is that this HK, the purity of a subsystem of size K, it won't actually go to the maximally mixed state, 2 to the minus K, but it will be actually fairly close to that. So it will drop below 1 plus delta times 2 to the minus K. And the curve will actually be some kind of nice decay of this type. And so if you look at HK plus 1, it will decay in a similar fashion. And if we just want to do a quick and dirty analysis of how this behaves, if we let TK be the time at which this purity, this average purity, drops below the threshold value telling you it's close to equilibrium, right? So on the graph, there's TK, and this will be TK plus 1. We see, of course, TK plus 1 is larger than TK, right? But to scramble a bigger system takes more time. And the equation, if we think about times past the equilibrium time for k minus 1, we can replace the value of k minus 1 in the equation by an equilibrium value. And then we can also use the fact that hk plus 1 is smaller than hk to go to get another line in the equation. And so at least sort of quick and dirty, this looks like exponential decay. And the rate of decay looks like minus 3k, right? So it's decaying faster and faster for larger and larger values of k. And so the additional time beyond the additional time required for a system of size k to equilibrate as compared to a system of size k minus 1 is going to be order 1 over k, because the rate is proportional to k. And so adding up this telescoping series, what we find is that the actual time required to scramble a system of size k is a sum of 1 over k, which is a log. So I wanted to show this because this shows you one way that you can actually get a log to describe this scrambling process. Yeah, you're right. Okay, so if you want to be more careful, you can actually solve this thing almost exactly using one little approximation. You get, you know, in terms of some hypergeometric functions, study the asymptotics of the hypergeometric functions, and you'll recover the log. Okay, so the take home, these Brownian circuits, they do scramble very effectively, but they require a large injection of randomness. They're certainly not time independent, and so we have to try harder. We have to look further. And a very, very simple model, you know, the Forrest Gump of models is actually going to be fairly instructive, which is just a very simple icing model that you wouldn't think would be capable of scrambling because it's so simple. It doesn't seem to do much of anything at all, but it does more than you would think. So this is really just icing model without even having a transverse field, just a field aligned with the sigma z's. And this doesn't scramble, of course, right? Because the eigenstates are just products of spin up and spin down. But we could consider scrambling of information in the conjugate basis, right? So this isn't going to be a complete scrambler, but it could be a scrambler for information in a basis corresponding to eigenstates of products of sigma x operators instead of sigma z's. So our initial state is going to be a product of zeros and say 0 plus 1's, eigenstates of sigma x. And this guy at time pi will reach a maximum in the entanglement, a maximum in the scrambling, so in a constant amount of time. And you can characterize the state very succinctly if you want to this way, as the simultaneous eigenstate of some collection of commuting operators. But to make this sensible, we should actually change the normalization of the Hamiltonian, because the initial state is going to have an expected energy. Not necessarily. Sorry, I should have just said we have a graph G. So the spins are on the vertices, and then, yeah, the just a general graph. But in general, the energy is going to scale with the number of edges and not the number of vertices. And the energy should be extensive for this to be a reasonable question. So we're going to renormalize the Hamiltonian so that the expected energy is proportional to the number of vertices rather than the number of edges. So we could look at the, you know, if you want to make a lot of entanglement, the natural place to look is the complete graph, everyone connected to everyone. That turns out to be a bad idea for this very specific Hamiltonian because it turns out that the state that you generate is locally unitarily equivalent to something of this type. So that the amount of entanglement, if you look at the reduced density operator for some collection of spins, it's always one of two values instead of one of a large number of values. So there's not a lot of entanglement entropy there. So how does entanglement behave more generally in these systems? Well, if we partition the vertices into an A subset and a B subset, then we can describe the entanglement in terms of the adjacency matrix. So the adjacency matrix of the graph has different pieces. We're interested in, say, the rows are vertices of A, the columns are vertices of B, and we include ones where there are edges from A to B and zeros otherwise. And the entanglement entropy of the resulting reduced density operator has a very, very simple form. So the entanglement entropy, I'll remind you, is just minus the trace of rho log rho of the density operator. It measures how much entanglement is there. It's actually the rank as a matrix over Z2 of the adjacency matrix. So if we want to generate lots of entanglement, have a good scrambler, what we need is to make sure that this adjacency matrix has maximum rank whenever possible. And it's easy to do that. You just make the graph a random graph. So we'll just say that the probability that a given UV is an edge is just some probability P. And if we want this to scramble quickly, what we want is actually a sparse graph because of the way that we've normalized the Hamiltonian. And the sparsest graph that will actually produce maximal entanglement with high probability is the graph in which that edge probability is log n over n. And what that translates into, once again, is that the scrambling time is proportional to the log of the number of degrees of freedom. This is a weak scrambling time, I should say again, right? Because we haven't really scrambled the system. We've only scrambled in this basis conjugate to the natural basis. But we've decohered, right? We've spread out the information in the conjugate basis in time logarithmic and n. A Cayley tree is a sparse graph, but it's not a random graph like this. It has different structure, right? Because it doesn't have any loops. A Cayley graph would not, I don't think. Yeah. I suspect not, as much as I would like to answer that question in the affirmative. Yeah. Yeah, well, what we should really be doing here is probably be working in the canonical ensemble, right, and starting the state as a thermal state with some small perturbation. So I'm going to address that a little bit on the next slide, actually, because I'm not fully convinced. So why would we do this, right? So the energy scale is some splitting between sort of the states that are appearing in the problem. And if we look at these states, we go all the way from the ground state to the most excited state in the problem. Right? So the energy the energies that appear when you look at the expectation value range from zero all the way up to sort of if we drop the normalization number of edges. So I want to make the splittings extensive. Because in Lenny and Sacchino's original conjecture, the time was temperature times time. So the temperature is setting the energy scale in the problem. So I think that's probably the appropriate thing to do here. But I'm not sure. And if I drop P below this amount, then I won't actually be scrambling in the same sense. I won't be generating this maximal entanglement. So it's not like I didn't throw in the log by hand. The log came out by the requirement that we actually make this a system that produces as much entanglement as possible and release scrambles.
The reason the log came out is because of normalization effect.
Yes. Yeah. Right. So if you want to get rid of that, what you can do is you can look at the ratio. What we did actually with the Brownian circuits is we looked at the ratio of the time to scramble k sites, the time to scramble one site. So we could do the same thing here. And locally, a sparse random graph really is tree-like, right? Because if you look at one vertex, it connects to some other vertices. Those vertices connect to some others, but the probability that you're actually going to go back to where you started, as long as you don't go very far, is not large. And only eventually do you actually find an edge that comes back. And so you can approximate this for smaller times by solving the Ising model directly on a tree. And what you find there is the time to scramble single site with this normalization isn't constant. It's actually log n to the power of a half. And so the ratio of the time to scramble a system of size order n to scrambling a system of size 1 is now the square root of the log, which is faster than scrambling conjecture. So we could ask, is this a violation of the scrambling conjecture? It's not clear because we're doing something weaker because we're only scrambling in this one fixed basis. But it might be, you know, slightly worrisome. And on that note, I'd like to actually go back to the black hole picture. Not that I really think that this simple Ising model has anything to do with the black hole, but just to think about the connection between decoherence in this sense and information. And so if our goal was to send a classical message, not a quantum state, but a classical message through this system M into the radiation, then that's actually equivalent to establishing classical correlation between some reference and the radiation. And establishing that classical correlation is equivalent to actually decohering the black hole system in the basis that defines that information. So if there's a basis of the black hole system in which we've actually decohered the state, so the state has the form an average over some classical value of the reference and same value on the black hole system, then what that tells us is that the only way to decohere is if there's another copy of that information, and the only place that information can be is out in the radiation. And so sending classical information is the same as decoherence, so the kind of weak scrambling that we see in the Ising model does actually allow you to communicate, but only to communicate classical data. And the consistency with black hole complementarity, if you recall, depended on the fact that you were sending quantum mechanical information through the black hole, because if you wanted to argue that you could clone, you had to be able to send superpositions. And so even if it is possible to construct Hamiltonians that violate the scrambling conjecture with respect to a specific basis, that doesn't actually threaten the consistency of black hole complementarity. And I think I'm actually already running low on time. So I'll just fast forward a little bit. There's a third example that just tells us how we can actually take a... the conjecture is not specifically with respect to position. It's with respect to some physically natural decomposition of the Hilbert space. And I'm not sure if I can be that much more specific. Can you be more specific, Lenny? No. OK. So there's actually a general prescription for taking a time-dependent Hamiltonian, a quantum circuit, and converting it into a time-independent Hamiltonian. And that method, it won't be any surprise to the cosmologist, because all you need to do is include a clock in your system. And so that gives us a third method, which I won't go into in detail, of constructing scramblers from quantum circuits. I guess I'm going to end just by telling you a little bit about the fact that the questions that we're asking, in some sense, are natural from a quantum information perspective, in that they're connected to questions about the de-randomization of various algorithms. And so we could try to parameterize the quality of scrambling by the size of the set of perturbations that we can forget about, which is sort of the adversarial, in computer science terms, how adversarial a scenario we can deal with. We can quantify the amount of randomness we need to inject in order to get the thing to work. And also we can quantify the quality of the distinguishability of the black hole states given different perturbations. And on a graph, say that large amounts of randomness is bad, so I've plotted it down this way. And we want as much adversarially, we want to be as adversarial as possible. We want to be able to scramble as much information as we can. And the Brownian circuits lie over here. Right? The Brownian circuits, they can handle any input state, but we have to inject ridiculous quantities of randomness because it's a continuous time Markov process. The icing example is all the way over here, right? Because it only scrambles in some fixed basis, but once you've chosen the graph, it's fixed, and that same graph is good for scrambling all the states in that basis. The Feynman simulator construction coupled with the Dankert circuit sort of lies in between. You inject less randomness, but you also can't handle as large a set of inputs because you have that clock there, among other things, and you don't scramble the clock degrees of freedom. Now, from a quantum information perspective, we actually know that you can do much better. We know that a generic unitary transformation will scramble all the information in a subspace whose size is the whole system minus some constant number of qubits. Right? So for an entire black hole, all of the states, all of the input states in principle could be scrambled except for some very, very small subsystem with no randomness whatsoever. And the frontier that we're working on in quantum information is kind of to try to get close to this point. And I think that work that we're doing right now tells us that is building a circuit that will be able to achieve something close to this point right here. But it's, again, from the point of view of describing something you'll find in nature, extremely unlikely. It involves three kinds of error-correcting codes, permutation, efficiently invertible permutation extractors, and so on and so forth, lots of gadgets. But just to tell you that the process of de-randomization, which we care about a lot in quantum information and just classical computer science, is sort of very much in the spirit of what we're trying to do when we find fast scramblers. And finding a fast scrambler would actually probably contribute something of interest to quantum information, because the scrambling property, we use it all the time in quantum information, and if you can find a good fast scrambler, presumably that's something that's relatively easy to make as compared to a complicated quantum circuit. So since I think I'm out of time, I won't be able to tell you about the lower bounds, other than to tell you that if you have a Hamiltonian on a complete graph, and you subject that Hamiltonian to a certain normalization assumption, then you can, in fact, prove that the scrambling time has to scale logarithmically with the number of degrees of freedom. Unfortunately, the assumptions for this theorem are too strong at the moment to apply, for example, to the BFSS Hamiltonian. I think the technology has improved a little bit, but it's this norm bound on the Hamiltonian, that the terms are actually, you use this norm bound, and that's unnatural in that setting. But there are ways to get around it, and I'm not sure yet whether it may be possible. Oh, finite temperature makes it much easier. So this is a bound that is supposed to apply for all possible states. It's not just speed of sound. It's sort of universal. And I think since I am running out of time, I'll just tell you what we're looking for: the duck-billed platypus of scramblers, right? But I've given you three examples. Collectively, those three examples have all the properties that we're looking for, but none of them individually does. And so we're still on the lookout. We have, you know, we're basically just grinding through different systems. But if anybody has an idea for a system that in which you can actually analyze the time evolution in detail and show that it's generating lots of entanglement, that's the trick, right? There's a trade-off. It's easy to write down Hamiltonians that probably generate lots of entanglement, but they're very complicated and hard to solve. But if anyone has an idea, we'd love to talk to you. And thanks for your attention. Ah, yes. Oops, sorry. So I didn't get to this, but so there's this paper by Asplin, Berenstein, and Trancanelli, just came out fairly recently, in which they looked at the classical time evolution, as you say, of the matrix models. And I think there probably is something to be learned from that. So the paper that they have so far is very preliminary. So you can't actually extract any information about the scaling with the size of the system. But it looks like some time scale related to the time scale on which what you'll be able to learn about if you study the classical system is how quickly an initial state of this presumably chaotic system becomes spread out over the whole phase space. I think so that time scale, I think, is a lower bound on the scrambling time scale, and probably a decent substitute for it. Although I don't know of any proof that they have to be the same. Right. So I think that the H bar comes, if you look at the classical system, is going to, when you ask, have you actually spread out over the whole phase space, you have to discretize the phase space. And I think that's, I think it's very much in the same spirit. Yeah. I think you need more than just the vacuum state. Typically, like what you really need is the you're interested in how different states evolve in time, and so subject to some assumptions, you can learn a lot about the system just by looking at the vacuum state. I guess in quantum field theory, but in these sort of free form models, there are lots of different time evolutions at all the same ground state. So the kind of property that you, like a priori, want something that you'd be looking for, you'd want the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian to all be highly entangled. In the case of the Ising model, that's of course not true. But that the fact that the eigenstates are not highly entangled ensures that it's not really a very good scrambler. So by looking at the ground state, you can learn something. But I think you actually have to go beyond to look at excited states. Yes, I think that's again. Like, so this property about the entanglement structure is one such. Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that you could. In principle, you might be able to construct a system that has a highly unentangled ground state, but has highly entangled excited states. And then at finite temperature, only the excited states would really matter. But I think that would be kind of a marginal case. So again, like, I think that you could write down necessary conditions that would basically amount to the need for large amounts of entanglement. Beyond that, I don't know what else you would say.